We're going to the panel now on the practical 12 steps, but I do want to remind you folks that if you do want to make a comment or ask a question, please go to a microphone, because we want to record it, and we can't unless you go to one of the microphones on one of the sides. And you'll have, I'm sure, an opportunity after this panel to ask a few questions. So there we go. This is the panel on the practical 12 steps, and there are two people, as you can see, who are on this panel. I'm going to introduce one of them. His name is John S., and John is from Kansas City, Missouri, and he is the fellow who created the website AA Beyond Belief. And that was back in 2015, and I love the site. It's got, for example, new stuff of late, a lot of poetry, news, podcasts, articles, a little bit of everything. And so that's John S., and now Diane will introduce the other fellow. Here you go.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hope you're having a great day. My name is Diane. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Diane.
Hi. Jeffrey Munn, yes. Jeffrey Munn is a licensed marriage and family therapist in Santa Clarita, California, where he lives with his wife and 3.5-year-old daughter. And he has been involved professionally and personally in the field of addiction recovery for over 10 years. He is also the author of this fabulous book, Staying Sober Without God. So, I read the second chapter of Staying Sober Without God on AA Agnostica. Right away, I thought, I have to get that book. I ordered it on Amazon. As soon as it came, I read it in 2 days. And after I read it, I phoned Roger and said, Roger, we have to have Jeffrey Munn at SOAR. So, wow, we didn't have very much notice. And Roger said, well, yeah, I agree with you. But I said, well, ask him, what can be the worst thing that happens? He says, no. But he said, yes. And we were very, very excited that on such short notice and a long way, he came from California. I'm sure he's jet lagged. It's my great pleasure and honor to introduce Jeffrey Munn. And so, would you please help me welcome, give Jeffrey and John a warm Canadian AA welcome. Thank you.
I'm Jeff. I'm an alcoholic addict. I have been sober for 13 years. March 4th, 2006 is my sobriety date. And I struggled a lot at first with the deism, I guess is the word I'll use, in the 12 steps. And at first I was so desperate that I was willing to give it a shot. I was like, all right, let's try this. People are saying I can make my own higher power. I can write a list of the qualities he, she, it has. And I'll give it a shot, and I'll pray, and I'll do all this stuff. And I really did. I really gave it a shot. I really tried. I was praying morning and night, really trying to give myself the opportunity to seek God or a higher power. And I like to think that I had a healthy skepticism throughout. You know, I was really looking to see if anything happened, and I just felt like I was trying to force something that wasn't working for me. Problem was, any time I came back to a sponsor or a meeting or someone to talk about it, it was sometimes gently, sometimes not so gently, I was nudged back in the direction of, you know, oh, well, you just have to open yourself up to it more. You just have to this, or you just have to pray harder. Or you just have to pray more. Stop praying for this and instead pray for this. You got to pray the right way. And so it was frustrating. And I eventually stopped going to meetings, and I had a relapse after about 2.5 years. I first got sober when I was 20 years old. About 2.5 years after that, I relapsed with alcohol and a couple other. I did a little more experimenting, a little more research. And then I decided I had to go back to meetings, because meetings have always been helpful. The people have always been really helpful for me. Just having other people that I'm on this path with is super, super helpful. And so I went back, but I decided I would kind of put more of my personal growth into my therapist's hands. And I was very fortunate to have the resources to afford some really good therapy. My parents were supportive of that, which I'm eternally grateful for. I realize I was privileged in that way. But luckily, it opened me up to this whole new way of thinking about recovery. And I got so much benefit from therapy that I decided to become a therapist myself. And so I had a unique experience of being able to do therapy and understand therapeutic principles and principles of psychology and theories of psychology while also going through the 12 steps. And I found a lot of commonalities there, and I found that there was no need to necessarily, there was no need to have the God part of AA be a deal breaker. There was a way to navigate AA without having to subscribe to a belief in a supreme being. But it just required a lot of translating on my part in my head. I was in meetings just kind of like, okay, he's saying he turned his life over to his higher power, and then, okay, what he means is da-da-da-da-da. And so I kind of just, I eventually got to a point where I felt like writing a book that I would have wanted at the time. And so that's essentially what my book is. It's a translation of the 12 steps into a language that makes sense just from a psychological perspective. And it adds a couple things in there that I feel like are missing, although there's not a ton. I do feel like the 12 steps have a lot of wisdom and a lot of, there's a lot there. So I kept a lot of the stuff that worked, and I shifted it around to make more sense for someone who's looking at it secularly. So I don't know, how much time is this whole thing? How much time do I have to talk? I don't want to go over. What's that?
When is your flight?
When's my flight? Tomorrow morning at 4:30 a.m. my local time. It's going to be fun. So I'm just going to briefly, if it's all right, go through the 12 steps as I wrote them. Again, I have the book because I have not memorized them myself. Again, if you guys have any questions, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but if you have any questions, please let me know, and I'll be around afterwards to talk. So for me, step number one, admitted we were caught in a self-destructive cycle and currently lacked the tools to stop it. So in that, it covers powerlessness, in my opinion, and it covers unmanageability. I wasn't a huge fan of the unmanageability part, because I've known some people who, especially around the time of the first step, they would look at that and go, unmanageable, no, I got my job, I got my this, I got my that, you know. So yes, there are aspects that are usually unmanageable, but I just wanted to focus on the fact that any amount of unhealthiness, any amount of destructive behavior, I think is enough to want to initiate the process of recovery. Step two, trusted that a healthy lifestyle was attainable through social support and consistent self-improvement. So speaks for itself. Three, committed. Three was one of the hardest ones to translate because it's super gaudy. Committed to a lifestyle of recovery, focusing only on what we could control. And I think that's a huge part of the whole turning your life over, is really not necessarily that we're turning our lives over to something outside of ourselves. We're just stopping trying to control every single aspect of it, because that drives us crazy. It drove me crazy. I don't know if you guys had the same experience. It drove me crazy. Because I can't control, there's only so many things I can control. So that was the focus. So I'm going into this program with the focus of what can I do, what can I change, what can I control. Step four, talked about earlier, made a comprehensive list of our resentments, fears, and harmful actions. Step 5, shared our lists with a trustworthy person. Again, very similar to the original step. Step 6, made a list of our unhealthy character traits. Not a fan of the character defects word. We're not broken. We have, due to a combination of nature and nurture, we have developed techniques to try and make it through life and not lose our minds. And a lot of these techniques are not necessarily healthy, but they served us in some way, shape, or form. And so I think we need to honor that and honor that they had a place in our lives and that they did serve a purpose for us and were functional. But now, if we want to live sober and we want to have a healthy lifestyle, they need to be brought into balance and we need to learn how to live with those character traits in a more balanced way. 7, began cultivating healthy character traits through consistent positive behavior. So again, this one is also pretty heavy on the God in the original one. You're turning your character defects over to God or your higher power. I know through personal experience and through what I've learned as a therapist that we have some power over that. If we want to be less selfish, we can do more selfless things. And it will start to rewire our brains and change our behavior, and we will become less selfish people. And that goes for pretty much any character defect, unhealthy character trait that you can think of. If we have a tendency to be lazy, every day, find one thing that you can do that is more productive than what you did the day before. Find something new that you can do that's productive and take some motivation. And by gradually and consistently doing that, we begin to change. It's just the nature of human behavior. We're creatures of habit, and we can create new habits. And then the new habits that we create change the way that we think and feel and relate to others. Step 8, determine the best way to make amends to those we had harmed. I think that's self-explanatory. Step 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would cause harm. That one did not need a lot of changing. It's pretty straightforward. Step 10, practice daily self-reflection and continued making amends whenever necessary. This step, for me, has just been the most crucial in terms of maintaining recovery over a period of time. It is so easy for me, if I'm not paying attention and taking the time to focus, it is so easy for me to not notice that I'm backsliding, to just kind of wake up a couple months later and be like, wow, my recovery has taken a hit. I'm eating more cookies, I'm playing more video games, I'm binge watching more net, something's going on, and it kind of can sneak up on us. So step 10 has been just crucial in that, just throughout the day, every day, doesn't have to take very long, self-reflecting. What am I doing today to take care of myself? Have I hurt anybody today? Have I been kind? You know, and you can reflect back to step 6 and 7. What are the character traits that you're looking to do? You know, have I done this today? Have I practiced generosity? Have I practiced, you name it. Step 11, we started meditating. I shortened that one quite a bit. Meditation for me has just by far been the most powerful tool in my recovery. It's the longest part of my book because I just think it's the most important. I think it plays into all of the other steps. I think we're more able to do all of the other steps if we're in a place of mindfulness. You're more able to look at your unhealthy character traits if you're aware of them, if you're in the moment and practicing presence. And then 12, sought to retain our newfound recovery lifestyle by teaching it to those willing to learn and by surrounding ourselves with healthy people. It's just about maintaining what we got by giving it away in some way, shape, or form. And I, in my book, I don't focus so much on sponsorship because I truly think sponsoring somebody is it takes skill. It's not an easy thing to do. And it's not something that I think everybody is cut out to do necessarily, and that's not a judgment. It's a big responsibility. It requires some pretty significant kind of self-monitoring. You know, you have to know when to check yourself and not impose your, you know, and let people go. We all, not all, many of us have caretaker streaks in us, and that can get kind of tapped into when we're sponsoring. So I like to focus on just service. What can you do to help somebody else, in or out of program? What can you do that will make somebody else's day better? What can you do just, you know? And that also, you know, can go into step 6 and 7 a little bit. It's just practicing thinking about other people throughout the day. Even if it's just like, I tell some people to set an alarm on their phone. You know, just every day at like 1 o'clock, think about something you can do for someone else. And then eventually it will become a little bit more automatic, and then maybe, you know, it'll start to happen naturally. And then, yay, we aren't as selfish as we were before. But I think some form of helping and doing for others is just is crucial, just in terms of living life, not necessarily for addicts. It's just it's something that is fulfilling, I think, for most people. So thank you.
Hi, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for inviting me here. It's an honor. I was a little bit nervous when Roger said, would you like to talk about the 12 steps, secular 12 steps? And a little intimidated by it, because for 25 years, I didn't even know you could do anything different with the steps than the way they presented them to me. And what I learned about thinking about the steps differently, I learned from many of you who are sitting in this audience. So it's like the student talking to the pupil here, really. But I thought what I would do is just kind of give you my experience with the steps in these two perspectives, because what I've learned fundamentally is they're pretty much the same, but we were explaining what we were doing maybe in different words. But maybe I should start with giving you a little bit of background about, first of all, what I knew about religion and God and what I knew about AA before my first meeting. I didn't know anything about religion and God. I didn't grow up going into any church at all. But I didn't really think of myself as an atheist. I didn't think of myself as a non-believer. I really didn't give it too much thought. I thought that I was someone who just didn't have the knowledge to believe in God, or didn't have whatever it is that allows some people to believe in God. I just figured there was something wrong with me, that I didn't have the ability to have that faith. So that's all I knew about God. I just said, okay, I'm just not capable. What I knew about AA is only what I saw on television and in the movies. I remember watching Hill Street Blues, and I'll never forget this episode when Frank Farrello, the cop, goes, he has a shot of whiskey or something, and he goes to an AA meeting, and he says, my name's Frank, I'm an alcoholic. I'm like, oh my God, why'd you say that? But that's all I saw of that meeting. I didn't see the holding hands and the praying. I didn't see any steps. And in all the movies that I would watch, there was never anything about steps. I didn't know anything about steps. Dear Abby, when she said telling people to go to AA, she never said do steps. So when I got there, it's kind of complex, because the steps gave me hope and disturbed me at the same time. I mean, the first step I thought was a really good description of where I was at in my life. I was okay with that. But I did notice God everywhere, and they had the traditions up there too. And but I didn't let that deter me from that initial hope that I felt. And at the end of the meeting, someone gave me one of those little cards that had the 12 steps written on them. And I was so excited, because I had a plan, and I needed a plan. And I'll never forget, it was a rainy night, and I drove my car to a payphone. We had payphones then? And I called my brother in Florida, and I said, Bill, I got to read you this. And I read him the 12 steps from that card, because I was so excited about having this. I said, this is what I'm going to do. So I didn't know how to do it, but I knew that you had a book, and I was excited about getting this book, because I figured that that book would help me figure out how to do these things. And I was disappointed with the book. It was different than what I thought it might be. It was very mystical. But what I did, without really realizing it, I kind of conformed to what my group was doing. And what my group did is they studied that book and they worked the 12 steps through that book. And that meant, you know, we would read, we'd talk and relate our experiences as it relates to the book. We'd get on our knees and pray. We did all that stuff. So that was my experience with the steps. I don't know what I was. I was a regular AA guy. And that was my experience for 25 years. And that's what I do with other people. Let's get down on our knees and pray. I mean, that's what we did, right? So after 25 years of this, I realized that I am an atheist. And it was there that I learned that there is another way of looking at the steps. And one of the first things I did is I went to that big book and I started taking out all the God stuff. And underneath that was what the big book says it is, a practical program of action. These are practical steps. So I was very comfortable with that. And I would go to my home group with this new outlook that, hey, you don't really need God. And it didn't go over real well with a lot of people. So that's why we have a secular meeting in Kansas City now. But basically, what I learned is that it's not what I believe that keeps me sober, it's what I do. And I did write the 12 steps in my own language, as I learned from you to do. And that has evolved over time. And I've got to the point where I'm a lot like Jeffrey. I don't even know what my own steps are because they could be different tomorrow. To me, all it is an expression of an experience. This is what happened to me, and this is what I did. And a lot of those steps are nothing but that. It's just something that happened in my life. There's a lot of lessons I can draw from that and some benefit I could gain from it. But yeah, it's very practical, the things that I did. I have detractors, and they'll tell me that, oh, you got sober in regular AA, you know. Yeah, but it wasn't the praying or anything that was keeping me sober. It was the other people in the room, and it was the things that I was doing for my own mental health. So anyway, I do have a little, okay. I want to tell you about some of the things I've learned about the steps from Jeffrey's book and some other books that I've read and some people I've talked to from the podcast. One person who I find really interesting is Jeb B. from the Freethinkers Group in Denver, Colorado. Jeb wrote out 12 steps for his group, and what he is really concerned about is the word we. He doesn't like it. He hates he says, don't you include me in your we. So his steps are all first person, I did this. And I like that because it is kind of empowering. I did this. And then there was it's not the real Bill W. It's not the old Bill W. It's a new Bill W. And he wrote a book called The Secular 12 Steps. And he is just in the vein of Jeffrey's. But for his book is probably great for someone who's just getting out of treatment. And he breaks the steps up like in three components. The first three steps being your early recovery. Then you have the middle part of the steps where you do your midterm recovery, I guess, and then your long-term recovery is 10, 11, and 12, those maintenance steps. So very, very practical stuff. And he also, as a scientist, he goes into a lot of the biology of addiction to help you understand that, which is really nice. With Jeffrey's steps, the one that I think, and I read his book twice, and my group uses his book in our step meeting. So I've really read it like 2.5 times because we're going on step 7 now. And the second time I read it, what really struck me was step 2, because it was different than how I thought of it before. You know, the original step 2 is we come to believe that something is going to help us. And I even said that. Yeah, I thought step 2 to me was I came to believe that I could find help in AA. His is more optimistic. His is like, I believe I can change and have a healthy lifestyle. And that is kind of what we were doing. That's what I was doing. I'm sorry, I was doing. I was searching for, you know, I guess, a different way of life. And that's what I got. So I love the steps. I sometimes, though, am a little careful with them, because I had this experience for the 25 years that when I look back on, it disturbs me in some ways. And I have memories of people who would beat themselves up because they were depressed because they weren't doing some step right. And I had people saying, oh, you don't need a therapist, you just need the steps. Yeah, I know. So, I mean, there are things like that. Now, that doesn't happen in our group, but I'll give you an example of something that I am guilty of doing. I was so excited about Jeffrey's book. We were going to have the step study, and I started writing up a syllabus for it, and it was going to be like a college course, basically, and we were going to also incorporate the big book so that these new people would have an understanding of the original steps so they could do these other steps, and I'd give them assignments, and they would feel this pressure that they had to get this assignment done before the next meeting. And one of the assignments was to read We Agnostics, and they hated that. It was just, I just made it a miserable experience. So, and Jeffrey says in his book, these are not things that have to be rushed into. So, I don't know what more I can say than that. I will say that these steps were designed to be practical. The way that they were originally worded were just worded that way because it was those people from 80 years ago that wrote it. When we sit down together over coffee and talk about our experience, we're talking about the same steps, but we're just using everyday language. Anyway, thank you.
Preguntas? That means questions. Sorry, I don't speak French, otherwise I would have said it in French.
Hi.
Hi,
my name is Dean. I'm an alcoholic addict. I like the secular steps. However, I think that there's something missing. I guess this sort of journey of trying to develop a narrative that weaves through the steps is something that I've been doing for a number of years, being in recovery for a long period of time. And I was watching a talk. I did a web search for neurobiology of addiction, and I came across a guy named Dr. McCauley, who himself is an addict. He's not a neuroscientist, but he's done a lot of reading. I would say he's an addictionist, and he described it as a disease of volition. And that really resonated with me.
A disease of volition.
Like basically a disease of your will. And that really resonated with me because it's something I've been thinking about a lot because I've always felt that, I use my neighbor as a good comparison. Like how does he behave and how do I behave? He's a normal guy. Like he's got bad days, good days. But he's always got positive will, right? He might have a bag of chips. That's his mode of self-destruction. Whereas for me, and this preceded my drinking and drugging, my self-hatred is much more profound. So I would cross that zero line, being sort of neutral at sea level. I would actively try to do something harmful. So I think that really distinguishes me from him. I think an expression of the disease, among other characteristics. Mm. And I think that step 11 really captures that. Now, I know it wasn't written, I think, as an observation of people who have addiction, because at the time it was written, Bill didn't have the experience. I don't think he had the experience and insight. It was just something biblical. Do God's will. It's a truth for everybody. Everyone who's a Christian at that time would be following God's will. It just so happens that with addiction, it's actually really helpful. I defer to if I want to learn something about climate, I defer to a climate scientist. If I want to learn something about recovery, I defer to people who are recovering from alcoholism. I mean, there's more to it than that. I think there's the power, which I don't know, in traditional meetings, people talk about people who are believers. They talk about the power, you know, hence the, you know, powerless brings in the power, the source of power, which is to them is a supernatural being that intervenes in their life. I think for us, I mean, for me, it's the power of giving and receiving love. So it kind of replaces the whole willpower idea that, so I have faulty willpower, but I've replaced my will with a group's will and the power, et cetera. Mm. So I think that's really important. I mean, in your step three, I think, I don't know if you covered that there, but I think step 11, it really has to be part of the secular. That's anyways, my view, is that it's really essential. Like, you know, approximately a neuroscientist, described a disease of volition. I think it's a really great way of describing the disease.
Thanks. You have anything you want to say to that?
I don't think so.
Oh.
I just want to briefly respond to that and say I'm open to multiple interpretations of addiction. In my experience, it's not been a problem with my will. It's a problem with my craving. I think if anybody had the craving that was that intense, no amount of will could overcome it. I don't, like, one of the things that I often hear people saying is, you know, well, you just have to be more strong-willed to, you know, and when you drink, just don't have another drink. And I'm like, okay, so what you're telling me is when you go have a drink, you then go sit in a corner and go, and try really, really hard not to drink. Because that's kind of what they're saying, right? They're like, you need to muster the will to not drink. And I'm like, no, they're not doing that. They're not having that urge in the first place. They have a drink and then they're kind of like, they're not really feeling drawn to another drink. So in my experience and the people I've worked with, it's more of a problem of craving than it is a problem of willpower and being able to overpower that craving. I think if anybody had that strong of a craving that regularly, it would overcome even the strongest wills.
Just to clarify, I mean like a will as in a compass rather than willpower. So it's just like, what are your choices?
Mm.
You know, and are they healthy or not?
Got it. Okay. Thanks.
This isn't really too complex. I'm Jerry and I'm an alcoholic. I'm having my 1-year medallion this coming Tuesday, and in our group...
Congratulations.
In our group, we always do a selection of from the alternative steps. So I'm trying to find one that, because I go to other AA meetings and they don't really know what goes on. They have a kind of like a bad sort of feeling, but there's going to be some people there that don't know what goes on. And I'm trying to find one that would resonate, that wouldn't be too way out there. And I like the one that puts the onus on us, and I'm kind of conflicted. I want to be true to myself, but I don't want to stir up a whole bunch of that, because I'm on good terms with everybody in the other groups. I don't want to sort of have them turn against me, but I want to be true to myself. So I'm trying to look for one that kind of isn't too far out there and yet be true to myself sort of type thing. Mm. You know what I mean?
I would recommend mine.
I would say, I would encourage you to write your own. We, at our group, I remember this young woman, her name was Erica, and she had a really hard time in the beginning with the AA groups that talked about God all the time. And she found our group, and our group doesn't have any kind of sets, different steps or anything, but she wrote her own. And she came in and she showed us her steps, and she was really proud of them. And that's what she worked. And you know, she might have a different version now. But you know, I think that's okay. I mean, it's what you where you understand where you're at today. So that's just my opinion.
Hi, I'm Liz. I'm a substance abuser. In a certain way, I've been in recovery since 1975. I'm 80 years old. But I came into recovery, first of all, through therapy, Gestalt therapy. I was a hippie. I ended up in India. I had a guru. I came back to Canada, and everybody around me was using, so of course I relapsed. And then I came to live in Hamilton. I met a wonderful addict who's in this room. We wanted to get into recovery, but it was very hard to do. We needed a new tribe, so we went to NA. So I was in NA from 1992, and I've always been ahead of myself, big ego. And so I needed a career, so I became an addiction counselor. And this is from that point of view that I want to talk to you, because as an addiction counselor, I felt like I was in a maze, because I'm also an atheist, and I was counseling people and telling them, go to AA. I went to treatment, they told me, go to AA, go to NA, and I was doing the same thing. And I myself was struggling with the God thing. I respect everybody's religion, what everybody needs to do to be healthy. And that's what I'm looking for in my life, and that's what I wish everybody in this room. At some point, I was doing everybody's program except mine, so of course I burnt out. And I ended up isolated, and as I said, I'm 80, and the healthy people that I knew have died, and I needed something else, but I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it for a long time. And a friend of ours died, and this friend, through this, a lot of people came from the woodwork, and I'm French, by the way, so if I'm missing some syllable, you have to fill the blanks. There was somebody in AAA here in this building who told my husband about this group, and then I went, on your mark, get set, go, because I so much needed a support group. And then the first night that I was at that meeting, someone else in that group said to me, look at Agnostic AA, and I found Jeffrey's book. I downloaded it that night. I read it until the first step, and then I said, stop. Maybe you should work the steps, you know, rather than read the whole thing. So I'm here with gratitude. I am. This has been missing. I know there are other people. As a counselor, I was very much for harm reduction. I was also working with people that had PTSD. They were coming from war theaters, from Burundi, Rwanda, the Congo, and so on. And it was very difficult because these people didn't want to come to these rooms, because these rooms are very white. I'm sorry, but that's the reality of it. And I've been in a multicultural environments all my life, because before I did all this, the other bullshit, I was an airline hostess. So I've traveled around the world and ended up in Hamilton. And I love it. I absolutely love it. So my question to Jeffrey is that, you know, when I was a counselor, I was following people like Peter Ferenczi, Mator Gabe, people that were working in treatment center. I managed a treatment center myself at some point, and that were dealing with harm reduction, and that were trying to find other ways for people to get into recovery rather than just turn away. A few years ago, people used to say that about 17% of people are either agnostic or have different awareness that doesn't include religion. And so I'm assuming that's pretty much what's going on in AA as well. And when I came back to the room, the first thing that I did was, okay, I want to make a commitment to this. So I had not lost my recovery. My recovery was keeping my life in balance. But I wanted a token for it. So I asked for a silver chip, and this, I came home, the silver chip said, God grant me the serenity. I went, oh, shit, you know, what have I done? Anyway, so what I want to say is, I'm extremely grateful that you are not only part of the people that are trying to bring more recovery into the world and open the doors to more people, but also, when you were speaking, and I'm speaking to Jeffrey, you said something about service. And I find that at this point in time, there's only two things that are keeping me sane, and it's having people around me that want a healthier life and service in some way. But we all have our own skills, and I would like to know from you, because you guys have started a movement. And how can we support that movement? That's what I want to know. Thank you.
I would say the same way that you support, that traditional AA was supported, is to just pass the message and share what your experience has been. You know, I did not hear, when I was getting sober in 12-step rooms, I did not hear a lot of people talk about, hey, I didn't, guess what? I took a different route. There was the no God route, and it works, guys. Like, if someone had said that to me early on, it would have been really nice to hear. So I think just telling other people that, hey, this is, by the way, this is an option. You're not going to burst into flames if you try this. You know, give it a shot. This is available.
It just occurred to me that I had a second question, and the second question is, when people come to recovery, once upon a time we used to say 90 meetings in 90 days.
Uh-huh.
How do you support the newcomer without diluting what's happening in the AAA meetings?
That's a good question. I think it really is a case-by-case basis. I think it depends. I think some people really need 90 and 90. I think some people need to be really...
I agree that they need 90 and 90, but I'm saying, how do we keep what you're offering, what other people are offering as alternate 12 steps, how do we keep that pure still while including the people that are getting another message in other rooms?
I think the best way to do that would be through sponsorship, having a secular sponsor, someone who's atheist or agnostic, to kind of keep that focus throughout the process.
One last question.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Tarver. I got two or three ideas I just want to put out there for you to respond to. One is the idea of individuality. I heard you liking the 12 steps expressed in an I language. I think my sense is that our culture is so hyper-individualistic. It's part of a context that promotes a disease of ego. Other parts of the world are much more communally oriented, but we're sort of swimming in it. It's I, me all the time. So I like the language of responsibility, but I also like the step towards a we because I have trouble seeing it normally acculturated, and when I become an alcoholic, it's inaccessible. That's one. Two is the whole power question. The way the steps are laid out, it's like power less, power greater. That'll, you know, hitch that power, it'll pull you out of the ditch. But I think that's also tying into a kind of a mistaken idea of causality. If all causes result from a power which compels their effect, I need that power. But that's not true. There are emergent effects. There are all kinds of other ways of interacting. It's not the only model of causality that's possible. And if I see the world in a theistic way, I see that sort of hierarchy of power. But if I am one of those people that doesn't see it that way, that won't make sense to me. So the question I had was how to... I'm sort of blanking right now. I had a way of tying this together. Anyway, those are two ideas. I had a way to tie it together, and I'm forgetting. I'll talk to you later. But maybe if you have respond to those two points, and how they fit together.
I'll follow that. First of all, I'm going to blink it now. Okay. First of all, it doesn't matter what words I use. It matters what I do, and the words I use depends upon who I'm talking to, and my recovery is my recovery, and the way I express it is the way I express it, and it might have a lot in common with how other people express it. So whether someone says I or we or whatever, I don't know how important it is. In fact, like I was saying, I don't even know how I would word it now. I just, you know, if I were working with somebody, you know, how would you, I don't know. So anyway, that's just my thought on that. But I think if you're comfortable with we, that's what you should go with.
All right. Thank you very much, both John and Jeffrey.